Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women.
Based in the gloriously sunny and warm, some would say hot, Brisbane, joined by the extremely talented experimental poet Pascal Burton. Pascal's poetic output meets at and crosses over many creative junctions: writing, performance, music, film, jewellery, and zines. With both conceptual art and cultural theory being the seedbed of her work, you often find yourself expanding out or going deeper down the rabbit hole as her work, on the page or in performance, unfurls in your mind, and more often than not, in your body. Her poetry has been widely published in numerous books and journals, for example, the Contemporary Australian Feminist Poetry Anthology, 2016, the Australian Book Review, States of Poetry, 2017, Volume 8 of the Australian Poetry Journal, 2018, and last year, a collection of her work titled About the Author is Dead was published by Cordite Books. She has also created a number of publications, artworks, and zines. Based on a response to the work by filmmaker Maya Duran, The Beautiful Unspool, which is a double-titled book object, performance and film, made in collaboration with Nathan Shepherdson. The Outlandish Watch, a 7-inch vinyl with tracks that can also be played backwards to reveal another poem, which was made in collaboration with David Stavanger and Nathan Shepherdson. In her zine series, The Voice You Speak With May Not Be Your Own, she curated content provided by other poets, artists and musicians, in addition to herself. And the wonderful Zine in a Matchbox series, where each issue fitted snugly in a matchbox, with a complimentary and solitary match for you to burn the zine after reading. She has also performed her work far and wide, both in her native Australia and abroad. With the impossibility of being able to cover the vast number of performative instances in entirety in this intro, a quick overview of her most recent: readings at the Poetic Research Bureau, Los Angeles, panel session and reading at the Asia Pacific Writers and Translators Conference on the Gold Coast, and a collaborative performance titled 24-Hour Gym with Tessa Rose at the Poetry and Writers Conference in Wellington. She's also been shortlisted for numerous awards: the Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award, the Queensland University of Technology Digital Literature Poetry Award, the Josephine Urich Award, the David Harold Tribe Poetry Award, and she won the QPF Experimental Poets Filmmakers Award in 2013. Playing keyboard and providing vocals, Pascal is also a member of Brisbane-based band The Stress of Leisure, who are a regular and much-loved fixture of the locality, and have also toured widely in Australia. So it is evident that Pascal is a creative powerhouse, and this intro is in grave danger of going on way too long as I gush and gush. As Pascal is my oldest, dearest, and closest friend. We met in our second to last year at high school at the age of 16, and despite living in different countries for a number of years, have pretty much been joined at the hip ever since. Pascal is my go-to on all things creative. She is incredibly thoughtful and extremely generous with her knowledge, time and support. In spite of the time differences between the UK and Australia, we find the time to talk regularly and email and message each other pretty much every day. We seem to never run out of things to say, so I'm pretty certain this may end up being a slightly extended episode. Pascal, it is with great excitement and pride and a little sense of mischief to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you, Renee. And might I add, I love this podcast so much and I love listening to it, and every time I listen to an episode I get so many great ideas and inspirations. So thank you for this.
Thank you. But you are biased. You are my best friend.
Well, so sue me.
Okay, so I should say we're recording this podcast in the back bedroom of your house.
Yes.
In Brisbane. So there may be a little bit of traffic noise in the background. There may also be the odd Australian bird call, which could range from a kookaburra through to a magpie. So I'm going to start off with saying, you know, whilst I've known you for 23 years plus, all the things that you've achieved when I was pulling together this intro completely blew my mind. You're bloody brilliant.
Aww.
And looking at everything, I was reminded of your openness to newness and collaborations. And I know I'm going to keep gushing all the way through this podcast, but I can say with certainty that you are so creatively committed and focused to your work. So I wonder if we can start off with you telling me, what is the role of an experimental poet? You know, what is it they do?
So I think poetry means something completely different to everybody. And I guess in terms of the art form, you can be a poet, but you can be anywhere on the continuum from, say, I'm writing poetry to express my feelings. I'm going to write for an audience of one. For instance, you might write a poem to your lover or something like that. And all the way up to someone who wants to create a body of work, maybe goes down the path of academia in terms of studying poetry. And a career poet is probably right down the end. And I think it's fairly fair to say that none of them are well remunerated. So to be a poet and to be an experimental poet is then having fun with those concepts and playing and breaking away from what the understanding of what a poet is. And I guess that's where I fit in.
Okay, cool. So I think it'd be really useful for you to maybe perform something.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so yes. We can get a sense and a feeling of your work.
Yes, so I'm going to do a poem that is from the book about The Author is Dead, and it's called Endowed Through Marriage with an Aristocratic Title, and it is after Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven nie Plotz. Usually when I do this piece live, and you'll know why in a bit, I kind of set the expectation that it could be a train wreck, and we just have to buckle up. So she, her, next she, it, then she stole the, from the, of a, of, and made a. The year was, the setting, its walls painted. The protagonist, an artist in her teas, known in as the. She came to see us. First she, the, at all angles, amazing against our walls. Then she jerked off the, with one movement. It's better when I'm, she said. It was very, but we were just as glad that didn't choose that moment to drop in. Shaving ones is like having a new proclaimed the.
Oh, poetry for one.
There you go. Poetry for you, Renee.
Thank you so much. Oh, it's just awesome, and I just love your work. I love that there's always like an intelligent playfulness.
Yeah, it is pretty fun to do the pieces I do.
So what was your journey? What was the path to arriving to being a poet?
So I've always written poetry, even as a young child, and I remember loving writing it at school. And when I was a teenager, I discovered the beat poets, like many teenagers do, and that kind of triggered a lot of creativity into me. Artists like Laurie Anderson, with this fantastic, innovative approach to spoken word or poetry. I loved her. But I was really just writing it as a hobby. And career-wise, I went on to become a high school teacher of performing arts and English and a few other subjects in there as well, but mostly that. And so I taught, my first teaching job was in the UK, and I taught in the UK until 2005. And I came back to Australia then with the intention of becoming more serious about my writing of poetry and seeing where that might take me. And when I came back to Australia, I started doing things in the poetry community, including slam poetry. And I don't consider myself very much of a slam poet in a traditional sense.
Can you talk a little bit about what slam poetry is?
So slam poetry is spoken word poetry, and it's often set in pubs or less ivory tower kind of venues. And it is often hip-hop in style or confessional in style, mm-hmm. or narrative in style. When I first started doing these, it was when Slam was just starting out in Brisbane. Mm. So I think I was a bit lucky because I pulled off some pretty weird stuff. Mm. And I won a few prizes. So even though I don't consider myself a Slam poet, I'm always very grateful to the Slam poetry community because it kind of was a way of moving forward in my writing. And the community in Brisbane was really great. I've got quite a lot of opportunities to explore my work and collaborate with fantastic people like David Stavanger and Nathan Shepherdson, who I just love working with, and Tessa Rose as well. So it's been a lot of collaboration because of that community, mm-hmm. and I really do like doing that. So when I was writing back then, I think my writing was a little bit similar to like a Seinfeld stand-up where I was, you know, kind of musing on things that happened. I really liked the odd connections between things, but it was a very musing kind of writing. And as I kind of found my voice a little bit more, I was clearly more interested in experimenting with language, in making soundtracks and music, using film in my work as well. So when it became very, it became much more directed work when I realised I loved cultural theory, and I learnt that when I did my master's in arts media, mm-hmm. and that was almost a religious experience for me, and also very influenced by the conceptual artists of the 60s. So that kind of gave my work a lot more direction. And from there, I had more opportunities publishing-wise and performing-wise.
Great. We're going to play now a pre-recorded piece that you've made. And do you want to maybe intro it and give it?
Sure. So this piece is called In the Beginning Without End, and it's a response to Julia Kristeva's essay In the Beginning and Without End, which is looking at the writing of Louis Ferdinand Céline, who is also known as having some anti-Semitic kind of history in their past. It's the essay itself is looking at Céline's use of ellipses, which is such a great idea. So there's a central or a pivotal line in the poem. Can a sentence have two centers, like two hands playing a piano? And that kind of has driven this piece a lot because you'll hear piano in it and so on. But really, another aspect of it is that we're living in an age where, you know, the current president of the United States uses language in a, it's so violent, mm. it's so destructive, and I can't quite believe that his publishing platform of Twitter, I can't quite believe how violent that language can be, and he's getting away with it. So mm. I was kind of toying with ideas like that. And I should say that this was published in the Australian Poetry Journal spoken word issue, and that was edited by two dear friends and great poets, David Stavanger and Andrew Galan. So that they asked me to do a piece for it.
Okay, let's listen.
In the Beginning Without End, after Julia Kristeva's In the Beginning and Without End. To have language throb more than reason, to have it fly off the handle, distinguished, displaced. Surges of an intonational curve, smooth. What does the language wear? Smooth fashion style, commas, classic flowery spring patterns coincide with objective expression, stupidity, violence, sorrow. Suspense and exclamation. A complicated mental machine. Vulgarity and sexuality. Sex and death.
mere stepping stones on the way. They are nothing but stage props. Can a sentence have two centers, like two hands playing a piano? A substantial plunge, those bubbling depths. Just fascinated, just nuts about rivers, their comings and going. It's true. Water reveals, holds, buried intimacy. A little atom of nothing, a subway track from deep inside. Someone is speaking to an ear. It is the gate of hell. The nothing at all, the staccato ellipses. She doesn't know, she doesn't care. Blank spaces, rhythmic bombs mesh with onomatopoeia and melody. Boom! There is more than one center. Crash! The death blows scurrying. Rat-tat-tat! Hatred knocks the reader out. The language is a war zone. And when you know what war is, you lose your innocence. Words come to an end. They are wiped away with a handkerchief.
So that was awesome.
Oh, thank you.
So your work is often, well, nearly always visual, with your placement of words or absence of words, the use of punctuation marks, inclusion of symbols, or the actual shape of the text, the way you lay it out. And you also perform your work, as we've heard. So can you talk about your process of coming up with the idea or kind of developing something, and then the final output of what we see on the page and also sometimes performed?
Mm. Well, it's interesting about the visual element of language, definitely. And my friend and another really great poet, Nathan Shepherdson, he talks about painting with language. And I think that that's very, very true, even that the way you can be inspired by the form of a comma or a full stop is just really exciting. But if I'm talking about how I might come, I come to my pieces most usually through a concept or through a reading another text, a found text, an essay, considering another bit of language. And once I come up with the idea for what I can do with that language, then I guess it's asking the piece what it wants to be. So does it want to be just straight up writing on a page? Does it want to incorporate imagery, images like vintage pictures? Does it need to be a film? Does it need to be a soundtrack? And some of them need to be all of those things. So it is, I don't really go, oh, at the moment I'm going through my filmmaking stage or anything like that. I just actually go piece by piece.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, your poetry crosses over the perceived and awfully firmly instated traditional arts establishment boundaries. It kind of tips and dips into the visual arts, theatre, music, writing. So it's kind of blurring those boundaries all the time. So how do you see poetry, and more specifically your poetry, fitting into the cultural ecosystem?
I like the word ecosystem because it is like little organisms interacting with what is currently there. To be honest about it, in many occasions I don't consider my work necessarily fitting snugly anywhere. Mm. And I think that possibly has an impact on opportunities or things that I do. So, for instance, I might have a lot of work, but it's not enough to go into a book. Mm-hmm. Or I might have lots of visual pieces, and Nathan is always going, you should have an exhibition, you could do this, da-da-da-da-da. So I'm not sure that it does fit too snugly in there. But it's surviving in there, which is nice. And I kind of just think that that all of the different art forms do talk to each other. They do interact and are deeply entwined. So to me, it just makes sense. And if you're talking about the ecosystem, can you just explain it again in terms of, are you wanting the business side of it as well?
No, or? I was thinking about, you know, you have the arts establishment, you have the theatre establishment, you have the music establishment, you have the poetry and writing establishment.
Yeah.
And yours is creeping in and kind of infiltrating.
Yeah.
And I use those as positive words, not kind of, yeah, in a kind of derogatory sense. But because it doesn't neatly fit, that's what I'm interested in, and how that the work then finds its place in all these very established, well, that's not art, oh, that's not poetry.
Yeah. So maybe an example I could give would be 24-hour gym. Mm-hmm. So 24-hour gym I do with a very wonderful artist, Tessa Rose, and it's such a fun project. Mm-hmm. So essentially we're performing tracks that are named after phases of a workout. So you might have cool down or warm up or classic cardio burst or something like that. But the lyrics for each of these tracks are derived from essays about female artists or interviews with female artists, and we create the tracks out of those that language. So it's quite odd. It also has a visual element to it as well. But Tessa and I found the most wonderful place to perform this work was at the poetry and the essay conference in Wellington in New Zealand. And we've performed it in a few different places, experimental music places, a few arty places, but this was almost like the perfect audience to receive the work as we intended it. So you've got people who are incredible essayists or poets themselves, and they're all just sitting there watching us do this performance, and they're laughing at all the right places. It was just really great. So I guess if I think optimistically that there are places for the work, but maybe it's not as easily accessible, and maybe it's not as easy to categorise as other work. Yeah.
And do you think you set out on that path thinking, I want to step away from that, you know, traditional, which I use that word, cringingly, but the path of what a poet is meant to do, or did that just come naturally through the evolution of your practice?
Yeah, there's no thought in it at all. I have no problem with any kind of traditional poetry at all. In fact, you know, I need it because I want to play with it. Mm-hmm. So, I guess this is the work that interests me. So, no, I haven't had a lot of thought into it.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned this before, but sustaining yourself financially through poetry. So you work part-time at the Department of Education in your capacity as a principal project officer. So this job kind of allows you time and space and financial stability to work on your practice. So where can you seek out funding, grants, remuneration through the work?
There are heaps of opportunities, and if people want to take that decision of I want poetry to sustain me better, there are many ways to do that. So, for instance, if you are a poet, you might consider taking a role as an editor. So you might edit a poetry press, or you might edit a poetry journal, or you might also have an opportunity to become involved as a programmer in the poetry scene. So you could be a festival director, or you might have an event that you curate, and so on. All of these are great roles that people can potentially do. There's not that many of them out there, so I think it's very competitive, but you can certainly do that. I choose not to because, and it's a selfishness really, because when you are working with other people's art, it almost exhausts your time that you can spend on your own. So I made this decision fairly early on in my writing, because I just saw it in other people that they would spend all this time and, you know, valiantly so. And also when I say valiantly, there's always that other side of it, that they're taking these roles to further their careers as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole reason why people would do it. But it's always a commitment to dedicating time to the poetry community. And I don't have that time. I want to write my own stuff, and I'm very happy to mentor other poets or to have a more off center stage involvement. But I know how much it saps people in those roles. Mm-hmm. But in terms of grants, funding, there are grants available for Arts Council grants. There's loads of grants, and they can be used to research your work. They can be used to there's a real thing for writing retreats as well, mm-hmm. that people get funding to do that. I'm pretty happy just writing on my kitchen table, so I don't go for that. And I also think there's plenty of other people who can benefit from that kind of opportunities, so I don't really do that. And the other thing that is large in the writing community is prizes. Mm-hmm. So you can go in for manuscript prizes or a prize for a poem. And so there's lots of things you can do to kind of buoy up your bank account. I just don't do it.
Yeah. I think it's interesting as well. I think you really play on your take on the freedom that actually being outside.
Mm.
I mean, I know in your role that you're writing a lot anyway.
Yes.
So that is obviously contributing to keeping you working with words on a daily basis.
That's right.
Is there a crossover between what you do at the day job and then your own practice?
There is, but it's a little obscure. So I work in the Department of Education, and I maybe it's important to say that I've chosen to take a job in the public service that is a kind of a 9-to-5 job, because mm-hmm. all the years that I've done high school teaching, you don't stop. There's no clocking on and clocking off. Mm-hmm. It's a really, if you care about what you're doing, you're doing it all the time.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh, this isn't going to allow me to write. So taking a 9-to-5 job has been a very deliberate choice, and I get to and this particular role is looking at supporting schools and teachers to teach the literacy of their learning areas.
Mm-hmm.
So this definitely impacts my work, because I'm looking at how people acquire and access language and communication.
Mm-hmm.
So that definitely has an impact. And the other part of it is that it's hilarious. It's a really funny thing to do a 9-to-5 job, and you are part of a big organization that, you know, works in its own way, and you get to just observe this. And I find a lot of inspiration out of witnessing that world. Mm. So, yeah.
Okay. So you've talked about being a teacher in the classroom,
mm.
and you're now obviously contributing to the school curriculum. So you've had kind of a direct access to bear witness on kind of how language, poetry, writing, etc. Impacts on children. So I'm wondering if you can reflect on that, about the arts within education and cultural development.
Yeah, and maybe a focus on poetry too, because so many people hate doing poetry at school. It's one of those subjects that even when a teacher sees it coming up that they have to teach a unit on poetry, they're like, oh, God, I hate this. So that to me is an interesting thing. The other thing, you know, I'm constantly meeting people who go, oh, you're a poet, I hated poetry at school, you know. So that's an interesting thing to me. And as a teacher, whenever I have taught poetry and being pro-poetry. Yeah. I've always had such fun with my classes, and they've really, like, I'm the kind of teacher who, when I see growth in students or something, an aha moment in students, it really does bring tears to my eyes. So that was pretty pathetic. But so I've had lots of those things where you go, oh, I might have had an inkling about a student that they would really shine with poetry, but when they, like, when students really access it and go, oh yeah, this is great, I just, it's moving.
Yeah, but do you think there could be a difference in terms of having a teacher that comes into the classroom with a Casio on their shoulder and says, right, kids, we're not doing the traditional reading out poetry out of a book and then going away and composing something and make it seven lines or whatever. Do you think that mixes it up a bit?
Well, that's a really good question. So I don't usually take the Casio in, and usually if I'm asked to deliver a curriculum, I tend to follow that. I remember doing this one adult course on writing poetry, and it was something that I was asked to do. I was asked to take people through regular forms and styles of poetry, and I did have some a participant in the group, you know, kind of pipe up and go, I didn't think this was going to be like this. I thought it was going to be experimental. And I was like, but didn't you read the blurb? So I guess in terms of that, I don't usually go and, you know, bring my bags of tricks to do the teaching. I'm quite happy to use the masters that have come before me.
I love that you just called it your bag of tricks. What would be in that bag?
A Casio, a circuit bank Casio for sure. I don't know, a sense of performance and things like that. Yeah, I'm not answering any more of that question.
Okay. So I'm wondering if I'm going to indulge everyone that's listening and myself more, if you would be happy to perform another piece.
Of course I would. So often I do poems that are in response to another text, and this is one of those poems, and it's called 36 Answers That Lead to Love, and it is after the experimental generation of interpersonal closeness questionnaire by Arthur Aron. Set 1. Ask a film noir actress to dinner. She knows about being a bad girl, hard cinema, dark cities, and Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. To get the pictures in the cloud, first set up the shot, disrobe, upload. Wrong light, exposure, consent, theft. The orange post-it is for success. The purple post-it has grace written all over. Peel at will. Are you cold? No. Blind Freddy knew that. Blind man could see. I was in love with you, but you weren't in love with me. Nostalgia caverns knit sound and space. Brain rings, chest belts tight, tight. Sing it like your live television broadcast. I don't remember how the rest goes. Mutton lamb as lamb mutton does. We were born to dress up. We all die in a star sign. Is it better to end in cancer than on the cusp? This page clogs with things in common. 26 letters to describe our hobbies. Same, same. This page is not the this page. This page is another page clogged. We bury virtual gratitude with paper-thin wings, like alike. I came of age in the Fitzgerald inquiry, easy-listening radio waves, pink lemonade. Waiting outside the RSL, we saw his pink thing. I'll send you a link, but you probably won't look. Legend has it there were 3 kidneys, plus 1 in the shape of a horseshoe. There are clubs for that kind of condition. Set 2. A house has many arguments, no collapsible skeletons, just whiskers to feel potential space beneath the door. I wish I could speak another language. I want someone to talk for me. Is it Italo Calvino? Learn how to learn, explore how to erase, then erase. The hardest thing is cleaning up. Air turns to tinnitus. There is something under the throw, wrapped in Manchester, sealed in envelopes. Themis, please tell your daughters I am looking to decrease my workload and will submit appropriate forms. They have given me until Aquarius, Pisces at the latest. Love is patient. Affection, played by Tony Servillo, has a quick temper. It's a real tearjerker and everyone's a critic. You keep secrets better than anyone I know, Mr. Kindface, Mr. Lover Romancer, Mr. Music Machine, Funny Talker Dangerous. On topic of family, the answer is either, how much time have you got, or is it hot? Still, I will tweeze and manicure her as long as hair and fingernails grow, till all is quiet on that front. Set 3. We are both in this room feeling. We are both in this room. We are both feeling. Cause leads to effect, leads to cause, leads to if. Colossal rock face in the small of my back, climbing in tense, muscle tense, crease, relax, reciprocal horse ride skeleton. Firebreakers, a sedentary imprint, but we still change the sheets when I bleed. The last crumble. Consent escapes, suction regret. It's for the best. Psychic pantomime deliverance. It's behind you now. The volume of what we don't say, the water in clouds. The fire is put out by our own water we are. Our water is put in the fire. My mother peels the purple post-it. The first number on her tombstone is Leo. The second is night. The fire eats her. Is she cold? She is a furnace. The city is dark. I want someone to speak for me. Is he Italo Calvino? I wish I could talk another language.
That was so beautiful. And I wonder if maybe you could talk a little bit about the poem and kind of its development and kind of the themes. Because it's quite intense.
Yeah, it is
and really beautiful
one.
And yeah.
So the book about the author is dead is separated into two sections, about the author and the author is dead. And the first section of the book kind of applies a lot of these texts to my own life. So the text itself is really funny, and I found it on maybe a social media stream of some sort, but it's a quiz that if a couple do it, you can find out if they're in love or not. So,
which we've done many a time in our youth.
Exactly, like Dolly magazine quizzes.
Yeah.
But so there's three sets to it. The first set is kind of more superficial and it goes deeper and deeper as you go. So as a result, that poem is going to take on the same life of the quiz. And, so each one is responding to the questions in each set and applying it to my own life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. It's beautiful to have that insight, because I think you do play a lot with structure and stepping off or finding pieces that they're incorporated and they become this beautiful other piece.
I think it's the energy of the original text that you're kind of marrying with. And it happens, so like I always doubt that it will happen. So I'll go into a project thinking, oh yeah, I'll see how that goes. And when it does happen, it's a really nice feeling.
So can I ask you what you would say skills you need to be a poet and an experimental poet as well?
So writing skills. Maybe there's a requirement for a love of language or appreciation of language and how it works. I think you could say you need the editing skills, the planning skills, to varying degrees depending on what kind of poetry you would want to produce. I think it's not vital, but I think a really good skill is to read a lot. Mm-hmm. So I read a lot of, and actually, in terms of my work, reading a lot of poetry, but also a lot of my work interacts with other texts. So other art pieces of music, that kind of thing. So having a broad input of work as well. And I also think you need curiosity. I think that's probably the thing, you know, that keep, like, there's no need for me to even think about, am I going to keep doing this? Because I'm so curious to see what will happen with the next thing I do. So maybe that's maybe the biggest skill required.
Okay, cool. And what would you say is the biggest challenges you faced in your poetry career?
I think if you want to couch it as my poetry career, the biggest challenge is that I don't necessarily want to play career kind of games. And the biggest challenge is that I don't consider it important to do the things to further myself in the poetry scene and so on. That's probably my biggest challenge. I just don't care about that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Why did that come about?
Well, first of all, I've questioned what the idea of success is in poetry. And if you ask people who have created names for themselves, or if you even consider the steps they've taken in their career to do it, then that concept of success is very different to my own concept of success. So if success means to make a name for yourself in the literature world, in the literary world, sorry, I don't have that in my criteria for success. And I also think that we live in times where opportunities need to go to other people. They just need to go to people who haven't been given a platform for their work. And so it's just not on my radar to be a go-getter or go after opportunities too much. Having said that, I still operate, I still consider that poetry is part of my career, and I do submit my work in some things. I rarely submit my work if I don't think it's a good fit for my work. So I don't submit a lot, but I do submit my work. Hence, it gets published in certain occasions and all of that. But I haven't been very good at sending out manuscripts and things like that. I feel very fortunate because the reason I have the book about the author is dead is because Kent McCarter, the editor of Cordite, he actually asked me, do you have any manuscripts? And I sent him a couple and he picked that one up. So, but I have been fairly poor in sending my work out.
And I should say about the author is dead is available online.
That's right. And actually, I'd love to say that Cordite is one of my favourite platforms for writing. It's great. It's a great the website posts issues, and the most recent one is incredible by an Indigenous writer, Natalie Harkin, and she has put together just a stunning collection of work. So you should check that out.
And also your book.
You can get my book.
Okay, so what do you love about being a poet?
Oh, it's just so fun. When you have a project that excites you, then it's just always fun.
Okay, so what advice would you give to someone considering pursuing a poetry, either career or something they want to bring into their life and you know, create a practice?
Firstly, you need to decide whether you are going to go down the path of trying to make a career out of it and getting a role within that industry. When I came to that decision, I decided actually I want another job to supplement my income, and then I can just do the work I want to do. So that would be the first advice I'd give people. I think I value the graft. I really value hard work and working at things. So be prepared to work on your writing. That would be something I'd encourage people to do. And don't be precious about your work. Like, see it as something that's a little separate to you. I know sometimes poetry can be very personal, but if you can kind of, during the editing phase particularly, if you can not be too precious, then that's always good.
So, we're sadly coming to the end of the interview, which went really quickly.
It did.
And I'm really surprised at how I've been quite serious, because I really thought I was going
to
be.
We've really gone deep into that, into my art, haven't we?
And I really thought my prankster side might come out.
I was actually wondering how that might manifest.
Because you've experienced it over the many years that we've been friends. Yes. And yeah, and I did feel a little bit mischievous, as I said in the intro. So we've dodged a bullet.
Phew. And when I say phew, I mean it, because your pranks are pretty hardcore.
All right. So what have you got coming up in the next few weeks and months in relation to your work?
So I'm working on a project with Red Room Poetry for the Sydney Writers Festival, and it is on, they've got a group of poets who are responding to an exhibition of Duchamp's work at the New South Wales Art Gallery. And the other piece that I am in the middle of doing is really fun as well, but very, very hard work, is I'm writing a piece in response to the silence in John Cage's Essays in Silence.
That sounds awesome.
It is. It's really fun.
I think what's been really great is, whilst I've been here the past week, is watching your process with Marcel Duchamp,
mm-hmm.
and watching you read, and read around his work, and read about his work, and read his own kind of thoughts and kind of processes, and then watching you sift and shapeshift.
Yeah.
Those kind of things into new forms, and that's been like what a delight to see up close and personal.
That's such a fun part of the process as well. And I guess, you know, if you are doing that kind of work, it's hard work as well, but I really love that part of it. Yeah.
Passy, it's been so lovely talking to you. But before you go, I'm wondering if you can tell me about a job or career in the creative industries you know a little about, but also would like to know a little bit more about, and I can try and get someone on in that role.
Mm-hmm.
And also a woman in the creative industries that you would love to hear on Greater Than 11%.
Yes. So I'm going to answer them in the backward
order.
I'd love you to chat with Kate Durbin. She's a LA-based writer, artist, performance artist and filmmaker, and she's just wonderful, and I think you guys would have a great conversation. And the art form I'm very keen to hear from is architect. I don't know if you can find a female architect in such a male dominant world. I'd love to hear how that transpires.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much, Pat.
Thank you, Renee.
I'm wondering if I can ask if you do a final performance piece to see us out.
Yeah. Okay. This is called Grace Jones at the Enmore and After Her First Orgasm, credited to Andre the Hairdresser. And it starts with a quote by Grace, which says, "Do you cry after sex? I cry. Vacuum suck the nerves. Desire soaking a shower head, fingers sea divers deep, an abyss, both nightmare and oh, when you crumple up your face just so. Sometimes at the hairdresser, when the dryer is hot enough, flicks the crown of the head just so, you think you might cry too."
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.